Hadar. Again, we are so lucky to be hosted at B'nai Jeshurun. I would like to welcome you to part two of our summer lecture series on the topic of dangerous Torah. Tonight you're going to hear from Rabbi Avital Hochstein on the topic of dangerous Torah in the Holy Land. I'd like to invite David Gilbert to say a few words before we begin.
Thanks, Ty. Thank you. I'm David Gilberg on the board of Hadar, and delighted to be here and delighted to see all of you here. And we're particularly delighted to have Rabbi Avital Hochstein here tonight to learn with us and to teach us. As I think you know, Rabbi Hochstein is the president of Hadar in Israel. By a scheduling coincidence, we were just in Yerushalayim and had a chance to spend some time with Avital, and it was wonderful, and to see and hear about all the great things that Hadar is doing in Israel. That's not going to be the subject of the lecture, but it's worth learning about if you have a chance to look into it further. And so we're delighted and honored to have Rav Avital with us here tonight, and look forward to learning with everyone. Thank you.
Rachel, the poet, starts one of the poems she wrote quite late in life with the words, "Rak al atzmi lesaper yadati." I know how to tell only my own story. I'm an Israeli. For me, that means Israel is home. It's where I was raised. It's where I'm raising my children. And I humbly want to share some thoughts from that perspective. We were hoping you might speak about dangerous Torah in Israel, was the request I got. I must admit that initially some names came to mind, some rabbis, some politicians, who represent in my mind dangerous Torah in Israel. But I'll try this evening to stick to ideas and ask what ideas, what Torah creates and enables danger. Implicit in the thoughts I want to share is, of course, my opinion, my notion, how I understand danger, and particularly what I understand as dangerous in the context of a land, a country, a people in a land. Rak al atzmi lesaper yadati, I know only to tell my own story. I do ask that you join me in this effort. I have a few notions I'd love to share, but I'm sure your questions will help me play them out, understanding better, so be part of the conversation. Since Talia wrote to me with the request to speak this evening, there is a song that's echoing in my mind. It's a song written by Yaron London. Yaron London is a journalist. He also wrote some plays and wrote some songs, mainly not so much poems, but songs that were lyrics for music. This is one that he wrote after the Six-Day War. It's called Mirdaf, Pursuit. And it probably is referencing what was called Eretz HaMirdafim, which was the area of the Jordan Valley and kind of the mountains of the Shomron and of Yehuda that led up from the Jordan Valley, where there was a lot of back and forth kind of chasing between the army and the Jordanians. And the poem was written then. I've since then seen Yaron London reflect on this poem with mixed feelings. Let's sing the first stanza together. Those of you who maybe know this song can sing it with me, and others can reflect. It's on page one, it's source one. Eretz tova shehadvash beorkeha ach dam binchalea kamaim izrom Eretz asher harareha nechoshet aval atzabeha barzel Eretz asher mirdafim korotea alpaim dapim vadav עד שנשרף עוד מעט כל חמצן ריאותיה בגלל מרוצת You can hear how the tune leaves one breathless, just like the description of the land who is left breathless in the poem, both from running and from chasing. Eretz tova shehadvash beorkeha. It's a good land. Honey streams in its veins. Ach dam bin chalea kamayim mizrom. But blood streams in her rivers. At first glance, the poem, the song here is describing the dangers of the land. Not necessarily the dangers of Torah, right? It's a good land. It's attractive. It has honey. And then we suddenly realize that there's blood streaming in its streams, or it has mountains that have copper in them. But in order to contend with this land, you need nerves of steel. Eretz asher mirdafim koroteah. Here, London does a beautiful play on words. If you look, the word chases, mirdafim, he drops the beginning few letters of it and turns that into dapim and daf, which are both pages, and kind of what's left over of all these chases, right? That you kind of see the dust in the back of those who are running. And the pages here are very significant because 2,000 years, all there was pages, okay? But we're left with this feeling of chase. And I think it's in my mind because of its connection to a few specific verses and to Torah in general. If you turn your page, you'll see verses from Dvarim. כי השם אלוהיך מביאך אל ארץ טובה, ארץ נחלי מים, עיינות ותהומות יוצאים בבקעה ובהר. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land with streams and springs and fountains issuing from plain and hill. A land of, we know this well, chita, seora, gefen, te'ena, verimon, eretz zeit shemen, and of course, what echoes in the poem, dvash, honey. Eretz asher lo bemiskenot tochal ba lechem, lo techsar kol ba. Eretz asher avaneha barzel umeharareha tachtzov nechoshet. A land where you may eat food without stint, without poverty, without being miserable, where you will lack nothing. A land whose rocks are iron and from whose hills you can mine copper. You already sense how London is using these verses in his poem. Actually, one of the words London doesn't use initially is the word miskenot, which might echo to you the arei miskenot, the cities that Bnei Israel build in Egypt. So this description is built in opposition to the reality in Egypt. Whereas in Egypt you built arei miskenot, you were working hard building these cities of poverty, of miserableness, in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel, no, you won't eat in the price of miskenut, there won't be slavery, and so on. Now, you can see the Eretz Tova echoing here, the stones of Avaneha Barzel, right, which London turns into the need for nerves of steel, okay? The honey is echoing in both, but it's Nachalei Maim, here water streams, whereas for London it's blood that is streaming, and so on. So the verses talk about a wonderful land, right? The land into which God is bringing us, his people. And it's such a great land he's taking us to, but the poem uses these verses, the materials, to actually describe a quite rough land where you pay a very big price to live there, and particularly a very dangerous land, okay? The price is there might be blood flowing in the streams. Now, doing this, using the materials of the verse in order to write the poem, creates an association, a connection, maybe conscious, maybe unconscious, between the danger, the land, and Torah. And I wonder if that's why it echoed in my mind, okay? Whereas London's talking about the dangerous land, but there's a hint here somewhere in the background that there's a dangerous Torah that might have taken us to this place or is guiding us within it. Now there's one more striking point I want to make from this poem before we move on. I think that creating a poem about the dangerous land out of verses that are actually meant to describe how wonderful and beautiful and positive the land is, puts in very sharp relief the gap between the imagination and the reality of living in the land of Israel. And that might be also part of the danger of living in the land, experiencing that gap. But I'm a little bit getting ahead of myself, and when we talk about Israel and the potentially dangerous Torah, I want to talk of 3 points this evening. The first point is Kodesh, or Kedusha, the holiness, the sacred, which is, I think, one component of the Torah that gives way to a lot of danger. The second thing we must talk about is the lack of a Talmud, or what I want to call the missing Talmudic pages. And the third thing I want to talk about is identity. Okay? So I want to talk about 3 dangers of Torah in the land. Holiness, the missing Talmudic pages, and identity. Let's start with the missing Talmudic pages. The use of Torah notions, ideas, values, language, in the context of sovereignty is new and almost non-existent. I think we're making mistakes because metaphorically, and maybe also physically, we're actually missing those pages of Talmud that can give us guidance about this new reality. We have no tradition about how to be a sovereign people, the owners of power, and a majority. I'll give a brief example through a Talmudic sugiya. Source 3 is a Mishnah towards the end of Tractate Sanhedrin, which has an interesting law and makes the following command. Ve'elu hen shemetzilim otam benafsham. And these are the ones who are saved at the cost of their lives. Harodef achar chavero lehurgo. Okay, one who's chasing after somebody else in order to kill him. Ve'achar zachar ve'achar ha'na'ara ha'me'orasa. Here the chaser is chasing after them in order to rape them. Okay, so in these 3 situations, the Mishnah is telling me one is saved at the cost of their lives. In other words, if I witness such a case, I need to kill the perpetrator. Okay, that's the command of the Mishnah. Extreme intervention. Okay? Now this stands in opposition to other examples, aval, harodef achar behema. One who's pursuing an animal, also probably for bestiality, for sexual relations, ve'amechalel et ha-shabbat, one who wants to desecrate the Shabbat, oved avodat kochavim, one who's going to engage in idol worship, these, en metzilim otam benafsham, there I don't intervene and kill them in order to stop the sin that's about to take place. Now, one of the questions that this Mishnah raises is who is being saved? It would seem initially that as a bystander, I am told, kill the perpetrator in order to save the victim. Right? That makes sense. I'm stopping the murder. I'm stopping the rape, even at the price of killing the person. The Gemara is going to ask, are there less extreme ways of intervening right now? Okay, maybe better to hurt his leg if you can, that's better, and so on. But the bottom line is that if there's no choice, this is what the Mishnah is telling me to do. But many of the commentators actually read it with more theological glasses on. And they say, as a bystander, I am told to kill the perpetrator in order to save the perpetrator himself, right? In a religious environment, saving somebody from doing a sin is also salvation. So he is being saved from being a murderer. Yes, even at the price of killing that person. Okay? There, to a certain degree, that's a more smooth read of this Mishnah. Right? Then the subject in the opening line is just one person. Elu hen shemetzilim otam benafsham. These are ones who are saved, right? The perpetrators, in the cost of their own lives, the perpetrators. Okay? And of course, it makes more sense also with the second half of the Mishnah. Now we can turn the page to the Talmudic discussion. In a very typical fashion, the Gemara starts a discussion, first of all, with another Tanaitic source, another source from the period of the Mishnah, and with an attempt to bring proof text. How do we know that we're allowed to do this, that we're allowed to intervene even to the degree of killing the perpetrator? Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, Minayin larodef achar chavero leorgo shenitan leatzilo benafsho. From where is it derived that with regard to one who pursues another in order to kill him, that he may be saved at the cost of his life? Talmud lomar, they bring a quote from Vayikra, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. You shall not stand idly by the blood of another. This is a very interesting verse. It's a verse that demands a lack of passivity, right? It requires action. Don't stand passively when there's something, some terrible thing about to happen that you can intervene to stop. Okay? It seems like the perfect verse to learn this law. Now the Gemara goes on and says, Gufa, minayin laroe et chavero, shehu tovea banahar, o chaya gorarto, listim ba'im elav, shehu chayav leatzilo. From where is it derived that one who sees another drowning in the river, or being dragged away by a wild animal, or being attacked by bandits, how do we know, from where is it known, that it is obligated to save him? Okay, a very similar law, right? A less maybe extreme type of intervention, but a requirement of intervention nonetheless in order to save the victim. And not surprisingly, the same verse is brought as proof text. Talmud lomar, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. You shall not stand idly by the blood of another. Now, our tradition doesn't love when one verse teaches us two different things. Okay? It's true, commentary can say very wild things, but there are some limitations to what the commentary can do. And one of them is a limitation on how much one verse can hold. And so the Talmud jumps up and says, Veha, mehacha nafka? What? This is derived from this verse? Mehatam nafka. This is derived from another place, from a totally different topic. Okay? We are now trying to learn that if I see somebody drowning, I should jump in and save him. Okay? How do we learn it? Avedat gufo minalan. When one is about to lose their body, how do I know that I am required to intervene? Talmud lomar. Vehashevoto lo. The verse prescribes, and you shall restore it or him to him. Okay? There's a play here on the words. Vehashevoto lo. You hear that it's a funny form of the Hebrew word. And the Chachamim, the rabbis, of course, pick up on this kind of strange vocabulary, Vehashevoto, okay? And they say, what can we learn from this verse? So we're in the context here of the requirement to give back lost objects. Okay? If I suddenly see the ox of my friend or the garment of my friend, I am required not to ignore it, but to give it back. Lo tireh et shor achicha o et tzeyon idachim. Don't just see the ox of your friend kind of wandering around. Vehitalamta mehem. Don't ignore them. Hashev teshivem leachicha, give them back to your brother. Now, the verb lehashiv, to return, appears so many times that there's an attempt to learn different things from it. And indeed, later on, it says, "Vehashevoto lo," these words. And now the Talmud says, we're no longer talking here about a donkey or a garment. What are we talking about? The person themselves. If I see my friend about to be lost, and here lost is metaphorical, it's not that they don't know their way home, it's that they're drowning in the river or an animal is attacking them, you have the requirement to intervene, to intervene. Now, it's worth pondering for a minute, what's the difference between these two verses? Okay, right? One verse says, "Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," don't just stand idly by. And another verse says, "Vehashevotolo," return a lost object to its owners. What's the difference between the two? Well, "Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," you hear the word "lo," right? The command here is a negative commandment, right? It's a mitzvat lo ta'ase. Whereas "Vehashevotolo" is a positive commandment, right? Pushing me to do an action. The requirement, "lo ta'amod," don't stand passively, is a call against passivity. Now, when there's a call against passivity, I can hear a requirement which is very minimal, right? When I'm being told not to be passive, a drop of an action is sufficient to fulfill that requirement. Whereas the active demand, "v'ashevoto lo," feels much broader and much more extensive. Right? It's not just a positive commandment, it's something broader to its context. And the third difference, which is worth noticing, is that the focus is different. "Lo tuchal li'italem," don't ignore, is a statement towards the bystander. Right? It's telling me, you can't just stand there. But the focus of the decree, "v'ashevoto lo," is to return what is lost to the owner. The goal is for order to be restored. For order to be restored for the other person, right? When I return an object to somebody, or when a person's about to be lost and I return them to themselves to a certain degree, okay, I am restoring order in the world. Now the Gemara picks up on those two differences and makes the following comment, and for those of you who are suffering from the Talmud, this is the last line we'll learn from this sugiyah. The Gemara basically asks, what's the difference between learning from the two verses, and why am I being pushed to learn from the requirement to return the object rather than from the "lo ta'amod," don't be passive? And it makes the following observation. "I mehatam," if I had learned the requirement from the negative commandment of "lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," don't be passive, "hava amina," I would have said by mistake to myself, "Hanei mile benafshe," I'm talking about intervening as much as I can with myself. "Aval mitrach," but to actually put a big effort into saving the person, "umigare gure," and paying some money even to help, to get other people to help me save this guy out of the drowning from the river or with the animal attacking them, I would have thought no. Kamash malan, I use the verse, "Vehashevoto lo," in order to say no, you need to be here extensive. You need to put a lot of effort into the saving of the person. It's not sufficient to just do minimal attempts, but "Vehashevoto lo," the requirement is extensive, broad, and active. The last thing I'll say about this, which is interesting, is that it means, whereas I am restoring order to my fellow, right, to my friend here who I'm saving, it could be in the price of a lot of chaos for me, okay? And the Gemara isn't afraid of that. That is fine. The requirement is extensive on me. Even if the price is big, the goal is to restore order to my fellow person. Okay. Why did I bring this Gemara? How does this speak of the missing Torah, the missing Talmud pages? In the 90s in Israel, there were two uses of this Talmudic sugiya in two very different ways. The first was by Hanan Porat. Hanan Porat, I think he was a minister, a cabinet minister throughout my childhood, okay? I think he was in the Knesset for definitely over 10 years, probably close to 20 years. He was born in 43 in Israel, okay, before the state of Israel was established in Kfar Pines. And his family actually moved to Kfar Etzion to live, and then, of course, was taken out of there in 48, okay, because it became Jordan. And he was one of the founders of Gush Emunim, okay, that was his political leading, very central in Mafdal, in the religious Zionism. And in 98, he brought to the Knesset a law that was then approved called Chok Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa, the law of do not stand idly by the blood of your brother. Okay? It's very rare, I know it's surprising, but it's rare that modern day Israeli laws are so intimately tied with Jewish texts. Okay, we inherited the English law. That's the foundation of most of the laws. Okay, and it's a rare thing. And Hanan Porat, when he gave the reasoning to the law, said explicitly, "I want Jewish values to play out and have room within our book of laws." And now we can read the content of the law. It's our source 4 on page 3. One is obligated to aid another that is present, if because of a sudden occurrence, he is in severe danger to his life, the wholeness of his body, or his health. Okay, so it's really taken from the Gemara. Okay, word for word, a demand for intervention. Okay, now, it's not very rare to have laws that require intervention. Okay, you might know the law of the Good Samaritan, which is in, I'm curious here, I'm realizing that I'm speaking with some lawyers in the room, I better be careful because I am not a lawyer. You'll tell me if what I'm saying now is Israeli bias or actually has some merit. If I understand correctly, the law of the Good Samaritan does something slightly different than the law of do not stand idly by your brother's streaming blood. We can read for a minute the law of the Good Samaritan. Okay, it's source 5. The doctrine that protects a volunteer who comes to the aid of an injured or ill stranger from being sued for contributory negligence as long as the volunteer aid giver, the Good Samaritan, acted with reasonable care. Okay? So the focus of the two laws is quite different, right? The Good Samaritan law, the Good Samaritan is a story in the New Testament. The Good Samaritan law comes to protect me if I hurt instead of helped the person that I tried to save, okay? Whereas the law of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa requires intervention, okay? It doesn't deal with my protection, okay? So it has very different weight to it. Okay. But actually, the first time that this sugya appeared happened in Israeli environment a few years earlier, in 95, if I'm not mistaken, around the murder of Yitzhak Rabin. It's the first time that I heard the notion Din Rodef, right? Din Rodef is our Mishnah, is the law that says you may kill somebody who's running after somebody else in order to prevent the murder that's about to happen, okay? And Yigal Amir, when he gave reasoning to why he murdered Rabin, explained, well, Din Rodef applies to Rabin. The peace treaty that he was going to do was going to bring to the death of many people, and so he needed to be stopped even at the price of killing him. I wonder if Hanan Porat subconsciously made his law, right, which is really based on the same sugiya and the same environment of Jewish thought, as kind of a response to Yigal Amir, to kind of say a different voice can come from Torah. I don't know. Now, of course, besides disagreeing with Yigal Amir on the merit of the issue at hand, is Rabin Arodef or not, this raises many questions of the implementation of Jewish law in modern times. The implementation of Jewish law in the political realm in general. how do we take a law that is discussing individuals and translate it into a modern political context, right? Which both Yigal Amir and Hanan Porat were trying to do. Should we do it? Is Hanan Porat right? I ask myself, you know, the Good Samaritan law has a long tradition, whereas the law of Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa kind of exists in the Talmud and skips to modern day Israel. Is there a reason why other places do a Good Samaritan law and not a law that requires intervention? And if we decide that we do want to implement Jewish law in some way, how do we do it? When do we do it? Now, it's true. The example I brought is a very extreme example. But I do wonder, as I said, if Hanan Porat had some subconscious thing that was pushing him in that direction. But there are so many issues that have not been touched through the lens of Jewish sovereignty. And so many issues that haven't been touched because we haven't had the opportunity or the reason to deal with them. You know, I think of the laws of Shabbat. We today use electricity on Shabbat. We warm up our food. We can leave the plata on. Okay, we do all kinds of things because Shabbat has been thought through at every moment in history as things have changed. Okay, but you know, how to be an Israeli rabbi? That's a new question. Okay, is it different to be a rabbi in the Upper West Side, or in the shtetl in Poland, or in sovereign modern day Israel? Do I have different responsibilities upon me living in that type of environment? Does it make a difference? That's a question that we don't have a history of thinking about. Okay? How do I live in a Israeli majority where different Jews, even if we at the moment leave aside the minority that isn't Jewish, different Jews understand Shabbat differently. Okay? How do we live side by side? How do we live together? What does electricity look like in a modern day country? Can we just stop creating electricity one day a week? Should we shut down hospitals one day a week? What does Shabbat actually look like? And all these questions, it's true we've been asking them for 70 years, but that's nothing in the realm of our tradition. Healthcare, you know, is the responsibility for healthcare on the state or on the individuals? Does Torah have something to say about that, about whose responsibility that is? Or taxation? Should we learn taxes from machatzit shekel, right, half a shekel, where each person gave exactly the same amount? Or should we actually learn taxation from ma'aser, where people all give a tenth of what they have, right, and then different people will give different quantities? Is there wisdom there? Going out to war, there's a whole speech that is given to soldiers before going out to war in Dvarim, in Deuteronomy. Does it make sense to learn from that? Does it not? What values are playing out there? Is there wisdom there, yes, to take to my day? Is there not? Is the gap too big because the Talmud hasn't been written for those questions and those laws? We don't have Jewish thinking about the realm of government other than very little and in theory. We're missing so many pages of Talmud. And wisdom, in my experience, often stems from experience and tradition. And we have neither in this realm. The Torah can be dangerous because it's misinterpreted, like I think Yigal Amir did, but it can always be misinterpreted, that's true. But I think it's more prone to being misinterpreted when there's no tradition. Okay, and so I think the first danger of Torah is the lack of Talmud, the lack of Torah about our new reality. The next point I want to talk about is holiness. I fear that holiness gives license instead of dread. I think holiness gives legitimacy instead of awe. It creates an illusion of ownership instead of responsibility. It becomes a fact to protect or a goal to strive towards rather than a duty or charge to connect, to contest with. It becomes a means to silence rather than a platform on which to express hopefully constructive criticism. And it becomes a tool for stagnation rather than a means to better, to change and to better. Mainly, I fear we stop seeing people when we're blinded by the light of holiness. So I want to take a few moments to think about the holy. The land of Israel is defined as a holy land. It's defined as the holy land and the most holy land. Okay, you can look at the source number 7, the Mishnah from Kelim. Esther Kedushot Hen, it kind of lists 10 different realms of the holy, but it opens with Eretz Yisrael Mekudeshet Mikol Ha'aretzot. The land of Israel is more holy than any other land. I wonder if the fact that we pray towards the land of Israel is connected to that, though when you look at the sources of why we pray towards the land of Israel, holiness doesn't come up there, and what comes up there is actually unity. Okay, we want everyone to be facing the same place when we pray, but I think it does work in the other way. The fact that we pray to Jerusalem, to Israel, gives us the illusion that it has to do with it being holy. It fortifies our understanding of it as a holy land. Now, what makes holiness, I think, even more challenging is that we come to this holiness, the holiness of the land, as owners of it. It was promised to us at some historic points. It was actually given to us from day one of our existence as a people in relationship with God. It's promised to us in ownership. Look at these verses in Bereshit. Okay, this is really the beginning of the relationship of the Jewish people with God. And very quickly, right, even if Lech Lecha doesn't tell us exactly where he's going, okay, but here it's very explicit and it's promised to the future. Source number 8. Bayom hahu karat Hashem et Avraham brit. Right, on that day, God made a covenant with Avraham. This is in Brit Ben Abtarim. It's the moment of the peak of covenant between God and Abraham. And look how early on this is, right? The hay isn't in his name yet. So this is very early in their relationship, in the relationship of Avraham and God. Le'emor le'zaracha natati et ha'aretz hazot. I am giving this land to your offspring. Okay, it's promised as something in the future. Minahar Mitzrayim ve'ad ha'nahar ha'gadol nehar prat. This is the biggest span of borders of the land of Israel that can be. And now the most striking and challenging in my mind verses. Et ha'keni, et ha'knizi, et ha'kadmoni, et ha'chiti, et ha'prizi, et ha'refaim, et ha'emori, et ha'knaani, et ha'gergashi. Okay, all these people who are on the land, the promise is made with consciousness of other people being in the land. Okay, with awareness of other people being in the land, that's where the promise is given and is made. Now, when these notions of ownership and holiness are entwined, people mistake this for license. And moreover, they hear that they must do everything to protect their ownership of the land, the Holy Land. Protecting the ownership of the over the land becomes the be-all and end-all of existence. Life almost can become a means rather than an end in this kind of environment. I think these are some of the risks we feel sometimes at home. Now, I want to share two different responses. Okay? I think this stems from a mistake in understanding of what holiness is. And so I want to spend a minute reflecting on what holiness is and what might be a more accurate definition of the holy. But before we do that, I want to share a different type of response that this elicits. Okay? And that is, I call it the slamming of the door. You know, the when we reject this notion, one type of response is to say, I'm done with the game of holiness. Okay? I got onto the plane to come here, and I approached my seat, and I saw that sitting in the seat next to me was a Haredi man. Cold sweat, tension, what's gonna be? And I went and I sat down, very nervous, and I peeked in the corner of my eye, and I said to myself, I recognize this man. I recognize him. And it turned out to be the Rav Lau, the older Rav Lau, who was a chief rabbi of Israel, and for many, many, many years, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And I said to him, you know, I'm just reading this Chernichovsky text, which describes Tel Aviv, and I wonder what you think about it. Chernichovsky was a doctor, and also a poet, and a translator. He translated into Hebrew the Iliad and the Odyssey. Okay, so he did important kind of basic translations. One of his most beautiful poems is Sachki Sachki, which says Sachki Sachki al halomot ze ani acholem Sachki ki ba'adam a'amin. Smile, laugh, because I believe in people. Now you can imagine when somebody says I believe in people, what belief they're rejecting. Okay, and the Rav Lau read this text and he said to me, he should have stayed a doctor. He shouldn't have become a philosopher. So we can so we can read it together and see why he said that. okay, so the text says, like the, I mean, just the title of the text, Ei efshar shelo le'ehov et Tel Aviv. You can't but love Tel Aviv. Aval ei efshar shelo le'ehov et Tel Aviv. It's impossible not to love Tel Aviv. It is, in the end, the one spot in the world where a Jew can be a Jew. Zoi sof sof hanekuda hayechida ba'olam shehayehudi yechol liyot ba'yehudi. Not a Jew by permission, not a Jew by prohibition, just a human being called Jew. He feels himself a Jew, not through constant conflict with those who are not Jews. This is the only place in the world where a Jew can live without feeling that he is a Jew. You can start seeing why the Rav Lau wasn't happy with this. With no need to know it. Like some Russian farmer from Penza, like a Frenchman from the Doubs River, to see the world through Hebrew eyes without being aware that other eyes exist. Okay? So Chernichovsky, really for him, Hebrew was sufficient, okay, as the content that filled what it was to be a Jew. Now, he lived before the version of putting together ownership and holiness that I'm talking about, because he died before the consecration of the State of Israel. And yet, I wonder if this kind of approach also stems from fear of that, of where that can go, of where the misled holiness can go. And so I want to suggest a different definition of what the holy is. Maybe we'll start with the Mishnah in Brachot. You know, there's different types of holiness, right? There's a holy place, there's a holy time, there's different types of holiness, okay? And the Mishnah in Brachot discusses a holy place, and the laws that are here regarding the Temple Mount are translated then into shuls. Well, we'll read the Mishnah and then I'll tell you what happened to me when I entered the building, okay? The Mishnah says the following. Lo yikanes לְהַר הַבַּית בְּמַקְלוֹ וּבְמִנְעָלוֹ וּבְפֻנְדָתוֹ וּבְאַבַּק שֶׁעַל רַגְלָיו וְלֹא יַעֲשֵׂנוּ כַּפַּנְדְרִיָה. One should not enter Temple Mount with a staff or with shoes on or with a wallet or with dusty feet, nor should one make it a shortcut. Okay? Now, it's typical of the holy place that there are rules regarding how you go in and out, and rules about how you act there. There's a woman in my synagogue who has taken upon herself the role of giving people shawls to put on to cover themselves in synagogue. Okay? Now, of course, many of us get furious by this, but I think for her, a holy place looks a specific way. Now, it doesn't really matter what our rules are, but holy places always have rules of how we go in, how we act within them. Okay? But I want to pay specific attention to the last line here. Lo ya'asenu kapandria. Not to make it a shortcut. Right? What does this mean? I cannot utilize the holy place for my own purposes. A holy place cannot be a tool. A holy place is not a means. Okay? When I, of course, didn't know we were supposed to enter from 89th, and so I entered from 88th, and luckily or not luckily, the gentleman at the door said to me, come, I'll show you how to get there. And he told me to walk through the synagogue, right, and through the secret doors. Okay, it was Bidiuk making it a kapandria, right, saving me the going around. I think the intuition of the Mishnah here, rejecting Har HaBayit, Temple Mount, and then a synagogue being a shortcut, the intuition is that holy cannot be of utility to me. Okay, that is part of the definition of what the holy is about. Okay, you should not use it for your own needs, and it can't be used at all. Okay, there's a contradiction between those two. We can think of holy time, of Shabbat in that regard. Okay, what's a good translation of the word melacha in the context of Shabbat? Who's gonna help me? Labor, somebody said? Sally, what did you say?
Creative.
Okay, good. Settled. That shows us the complexity of it. Because, right, melacha is not exactly work. Is a craft, maybe? Does craft come from creativity? Is it the same family? I don't know. Okay, but Shabbat is the day when I stopped doing creations, where I stop doing crafts, where I stop doing melachot. Because what is melacha about? Melacha is about productivity. But what does that mean? Melacha is when I take the world and manipulate it to my own use, to my own good. Manipulate not in a negative sense necessarily, okay? But I change it, I manipulate it, I work on it so that it can serve me, serve others. Okay? The sacred day puts limitations on ownership. This is a day where you don't own the world anymore. You cannot manipulate it for your own benefits. You have to experience it as it is. Right? You can't change things on Shabbat. Even the place of a thing, which is essential to its being, you cannot change on Shabbat because it's a day in which you experience the world as it is, right? I don't manipulate the world. So Shabbat becomes, the holy time becomes a day where I am, where there are placed boundaries on my sovereignty. Okay, that's what Shabbat is about. That's what the holy day is about. You can think of the holy language in the same way, right? The holy language is the language in which I learn Torah Lishma. Torah simply for the sake of Torah. Once I go to the doctor in Hebrew, it's no longer the holy language, right? Once I do commerce in Hebrew, that's no longer the holy language. Okay, when I utilize it, okay, when I manipulate it, when I take ownership over it, when I take advantage of it for my needs, that's no longer treating it as something holy. Okay, I cannot turn the holy into an instrument for myself. The holy is the realm in which I am told, put a hold on your ownership, put a hold on how you try to take control of things. Don't utilize, don't control. Okay, only then you can experience things as they are. I'm very tempted to read with you Bialik for a minute. Let's read Bialik for 1 minute here. He's on page 15. He's not exactly on topic, but he says something beautiful about language, which is worth hearing. He's source 15, I'm sorry. He's the last source. As long as we see our vocabulary of original concepts as religious, constricted, and narrow ones, we will be unable to grasp them in a simple, straightforward, natural way as general concepts of human culture. Okay? As long as I continue thinking of Torah as the thing there, rather than as any great philosophical idea, right? Or any wisdom, right? If I leave it limited to the realm of the Bet Midrash, it's going to stay narrow. This is a sign of impoverishment, not of these concepts and these literary works, but a sign that we are not yet redeemed. Okay, what a powerful statement. When we are still treating Hebrew as fitting only to the Bet Midrash, then there's no Geula. We haven't redeemed Hebrew yet. Okay, we haven't redeemed those notions yet. We have not freed ourselves and we have not yet digested these concepts. Now he gives a wonderful example. I say this. As long as the barrier remains between the concept of intuition, intuitia, and the concept of Shechina, or Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, and we say intuition is a general human concept, but Ruach HaKodesh, Holy Spirit as a concept, is specific to the Bet Midrash, the Talmud, religion, we will fail to translate without hesitation instantly between the concepts of intuition and the Holy Spirit. Okay, so what he's suggesting is that when we're able to take the concepts out of the Bet Midrash into general life, okay, then there is Geula. But since we're talking about the holy, I think if we're honest, what he is saying is that we have to turn these concepts into chol, into, what's the opposite of sacred?
Profane.
Profane, but profane is negative.
Ordinary.
Mundane, ordinary, good. Okay. So when I can say Ruach HaKodesh, right, the Holy Spirit, and I can mean intuition, then I am using these words in my day-to-day life. Now, it's true, maybe they've lost their holiness, but they've gained the ability to be part of life. They've been redeemed from the Bet Midrash, according to Bialik. Okay? The act of turning things into secular isn't necessarily negative. Okay? It depends on their context. Okay? So now, let's go back to the Holy Land. Okay? Just like holy time puts limitations on my sovereignty, okay, on my ownership. So also holy places should be the places that I don't own anymore, that put limitations and boundaries on my ownership. That's why they cannot be used as a shortcut, okay? That's where the misunderstanding begins and ends. Okay? The Holy Land puts limitations on me as a sovereign. One can say almost that the Holy Land, it gives me conditional ownership. Okay? Look at the verses in Devarim. We began our evening with the verses from Devarim 18, and these verses are just in the continuation of the chapter. Source, yeah, no, no, wait, I'm sorry. Go back a little bit. 11, not yet 18. On page 5. כי הארץ אשר אתה בא שמה לרשתה, for the land that you are about to enter and possess, is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come. Okay, there's a lot of dealing with the difference between Egypt and Eretz Israel and the land of Israel. There, the grain you sowed had to be watered by your own labors, like a vegetable garden. How is the water, how does watering happen in Egypt?
The Nile overflows.
The Nile overflows. Now, that's the concept we have, right? That the Nile overflows, and so I don't really have to do very much in order to water. Okay, here there's a description that it takes a lot of labor, okay? But we also have this idea, which is also a Torah idea, that there the water exists, okay? It's there, it's prevalent. והארץ אשר אתם עוברים שמה לרשתה, okay? On the other hand, the land that you're about to cross into and to possess, a land of hills and valleys, soaks up its water from the rains of the heaven, right? The Nile can't overflow in Israel because Israel looks like this, right? So the overflowing wouldn't help. Up here, I need to bring the water. Or, if I can't bring the water, where's the water going to come from? Okay, rain from the heavens. It is a land which the Lord your God looks after, on which the Lord your God always keeps his eye, from year's beginning to year's end. Okay, so there's an intimate relationship here with God. God is always watching, and the way we become aware of this relationship with God, of God's eye, is whether there's rain or no rain. And here comes the condition. If then you obey my commandments, right? Ve'haya im shamo tishme'u. Okay, if you listen, you'll get rain. If you don't listen, you won't get rain. Now, the content of the condition changes according to who's speaking and what they think, right? Sometimes it's obey the commandments, and sometimes it's be good to the ger, the yatom, and the almana, the orphan, the stranger, and the widow. Different people will put that condition and understand that condition differently. But the Holy Land, its central quality is that it's conditional. The existence there is conditional, and so the ownership over the Holy Land is conditional. Okay, that's the meaning of its being holy. Now, it is pretty exhausting to live in a land where God is all the time watching. Okay? That everything has extreme meaning. Okay? You can understand Chernyakhovsky saying, Tel Aviv is great because what there is there is, there isn't an eye of God always. Right? I can relax and I can just exist. Okay? It might be the difference between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. I don't know. Okay? But for sure the implication of the holiness is not ownership. It's exactly the opposite. Okay, but one of the dangers that we feel, I think, day to day in Israel is the misunderstanding, A, that the land is holy, B, that that means I own it, and the implication being that that becomes the goal. Ownership becomes the goal, and everything is legitimate in order to maintain that ownership. Okay, so we spoke of one danger, which was the lack of tradition, okay, the missing pages of Talmud. We spoke of a second danger, which is a misunderstanding of what holiness is about and what the Holy Land is about. The third point I want to make, and with that we can end, is issues of identity. There are a few basic components, kind of fundamental components, different and sometimes even contradictory, that I think are typical in Jewish identity. They stem from Torah, and I think they can be very dangerous when in the land of Israel. We can see the first one, when we talk of identity, of course, the best place to kind of think of identity are the boundaries, okay? And so how do we talk about, where are the boundaries of our identity discussed? when there's a discussion of converts. Okay, that's where suddenly there's a revelation of how we perceive ourselves. Okay, source number 12. In Tractate Yevamot, there is a long discussion of conversion. And there's actually different ceremonies described there. But one of them, which is attributed to a Tanaitic source, opens up with a kind of statement of identity to the convert, to the person who wants to come and convert, and I define to him who I am and how I perceive myself, and he is being given the choice, or she is being given the choice, if to accept that identity or not. Okay, so let's read this text together and see the self-perception that we have. Tanu Rabbanan, source 12, the top of page 6. Ger sheba litgayer bazman hazeh, a convert who comes to convert in these days. They say to him, why did you come to convert? Don't you know that Israel in these days are broken, downtrodden, swept around, and tossed about, and that suffering comes upon them? Okay? If he says, I know, and I am not worthy, they accept him immediately. Okay. Is it surprising, this self-definition? You should say, it depends what historic moment we're talking about, right? Okay? But this becomes a foundational text, okay? And the self-perception here, right, I'll read you the Hebrew, so you hear its tone. Dvuyim, tchufim, schufim, meturafim, v'yisurim ba'im aleihem. Okay, it's like this sing-song of misery, okay? And the person has to feel that he's not worthy of this misery, right, in order to join, okay? Now, when I have this kind of consciousness, okay, it puts me into a kind of protective mode, right? A defensive mode towards, I'm expecting the next punch, right? Where is it going to come from, okay? You can imagine why I feel this is unhelpful and inaccurate an identity to hold, particularly in Israel, or I don't know if to say particularly, but to hold in Israel. I'll let you decide about holding it in the Upper West Side in the 21st century. I think another text of the same kind of effect is the one that we say in the Agadah. And what's most annoying to me about this text is that there's a most beautiful tune that has recently been written to this, to these words. And everyone sings it before Pesach. And I think it affects us subconsciously, okay? And that's source 13, right? Vehi, the zchut, the havtacha, the brit, with God, always stood for our ancestors and for us. Why? Since not only one has stood against us to destroy us, but rather each generation they stand against us to destroy us, but the Holy One, blessed be He, rescues us from their hands. Okay, I was asking myself why I find survival mode so dangerous. Okay, I think one thing to notice about survival mode is that survival mode doesn't assume there is a tomorrow. Okay, when I live in the consciousness that b'chol dor v'dor, in every generation, somebody wants to kill me, it means all I can think of is the present survival. Okay, it's not a great way to build a country when you don't imagine that you're going to be here tomorrow. Okay, it's very limited responsibility that you can take upon yourself when this is the consciousness. Okay, and this is such a strong part of Jewish identity that we're carrying with us for hundreds of years. Okay, I think what I perceive as possible is both more narrow and inaccurate, or is affected when I am in survival mode, where I perceive myself as constantly under attack. Okay, what I perceive as possible, right? Right. What are the array of options before me? That array changes when I'm in a consciousness of every generation someone wants to kill me, or when I'm in a consciousness of I'm strong and I'm here to stay. Okay, and of course, what I perceive as my responsibilities is very, very different in both cases. Now, around our seder table this year, there was a very fierce argument. We got to the point where we say, "Bechol dor vador chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim." In every generation, one must perceive themselves as if they came out of Egypt. Now, around the table, we had a young man from Darfur whose parents were murdered when he was 3. He came to Israel illegally through the Egyptian border alone as an unaccompanied minor at the age of 13. He's 26 now. And he said, "Of course. Why must I keep this memory in every generation? To make sure that I'm never a slave again." And other people around the table said, "Why must I keep this memory? Because I have to make sure there are no slaves ever again in the world around me." Okay? Now, those are two very different perceptions of why I hold on to these memories. Okay? Is it to make sure something about myself, or is it to make sure something about the world in which I live? And it's not necessarily an either-or situation. Okay? But I think that holding on to some of the basic identity definitions of who we are, when we are in sovereignty, a majority, the owners of power, is both limiting how we think and misguided, because it's an illusion about the reality around us. Maybe I'll say one more thing and then we can end and open it up to some questions and responses if you want. The Torah has the opposite fear, right? The Torah isn't so afraid of us perceiving ourselves as having no power. It is actually afraid of us perceiving ourselves as having too much power, okay? Or forgetting the source of our power, okay? And that's on source 14, Hishamer lecha, beware, ve'amarta bilvavcha, kochi ve'otzem yadi asa li et ha'chayil hazeh. Okay, beware lest you tell yourself, this is all thanks to me, right? I merited in this way, I have all this wealth because I did this. Ve'zacharta et Hashem Elohecha. Okay, remember God. Ki hu hanoten lecha koach la'asot chayil. He is the one who gives you power. Now, this verse is amazing, because it doesn't say God does it all for me. It says God gives me the ability to do these things. Okay? And that might be something that we are forgetting at the moment, because we have such a long history of Jewish identity where we were downtrodden, and so we forget that God also gives us power. Okay? He doesn't only give us protection when we need it, but he also gives us power to build, to start, to create. Okay, I'll say one word of summary, and then if there are thoughts and comments, I'm happy to take them. I basically feel that there are three main threats that stem from Torah to our existence in Israel today that are dangerous Torah. One is the lack of tradition. We have to start from scratch, and that's true in many realms. It's true in many realms, but it's true about Jewish sovereignty in particular. The second is a misunderstanding of what holiness is, equating holiness with ownership rather than understanding holiness as a limitation on ownership. And the third is carrying a Jewish identity that is no longer accurate to who we are, isn't true anymore to who we are, and then creating an illusion because of that. Thank you. Yes.
So you didn't say this. I have something to be said.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yes.
To what degree, aside from your saying ignoring the minority at one point, to what degree does the other enter into those three concerns for us, since it is obviously very important to the current day?
Right. Good, I'm so glad you asked that question, because in my mind it's all three of them, and it's clear so I can make it explicit. The identity one, I think that when we don't understand ourselves as a majority, we don't take responsibility over the minority that's around us in a real way. If we continue perceiving ourselves as all the time under threat, we are not going to be able to give equality to... Okay? So that's the realm of identity. In the realm of the holy, it's directly connected to how we think Temple Mount should look, okay, and Jerusalem should look, okay, if I understand it as ownership or boundaries on ownership, okay? And we can say much more in that regard. And in the sense of a lack of Torah, I think it's most blatant, because I don't think there's any moment in history, definitely not since the last 2,000 years, where we were in this position. These are questions that have not been asked. Okay, now, I am a very traditional person. I count on my tradition. I feel alone. I feel lost. I have to recreate all these Talmud pages that ask, you know, do I just go back to the Torah where they talk of the ger who lives in the land? I'm not sure. Okay, there has been a few thousand years, there has been development of Torah, and on this issue there hasn't been.
Can I follow up? Okay? I came in a little late, and you were talking about the responsibility to be act positively. To act positively in the face of the danger of another. And I was wondering if you were thinking, or you thought the Torah was thinking, about just towards Jews, or towards...
No, I don't think that it means only about Jews. And actually, Hanan Porat, in the law that he creates, explicitly says Jews and non-Jews. Okay? Which is why I wonder if Retzach Rabin, if the murder of Rabin is in the background of what he's, of what's moving him to make his law. Yes.
I'm really going to follow up on what he says. It does seem that there's a theme that cuts across all three of the categories. And that is... whether we, especially those of us in Israel, whether we see us as together or separate. I mean, one of the interpretations of Kadosh is a concept of separateness. And when you talk about Israel, about the land, the question is, are we talking just about Eretz Yisrael, or do we have a concept that the earth is the Lord? And your example of the slave, that is that just, or do we identify ourselves as slaves, or do we identify with all slaves? I think that actually ties in with the lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. I mean, how do we interpret re'echa? I mean, in this text it's another, but it could be interpreted as your neighbor, as in another text here it's interpreted. And if that neighbor is just us and not them, then we only have to save. We only have responsibility to save those who are neighbors, are part of us. And I think that's also tied in with the concept of sovereignty in the rest of the world. Are we only responsible for the survival, as you said, the survival of Israel, or do we have responsibility for the rest of the world? I mean, a key issue would be that of environmentalism, if you will, and whether we perceive ourselves as just living in our own neighborhood or being responsible for others. So I think that, I'm not sure if I touched on all three, but I think that that's a common theme.
perhaps, in all three?
Good. What I'll add, if I understood correctly, what I'll add to what you're saying is that I think the stronger we're able to understand ourselves, the broader we can understand our responsibility also. Okay, right? Then it can go beyond the minorities that are within Israel onto, as you say, the earth, the world, slavery everywhere, right? What I described as the argument around our Pesach table was exactly that question. Do I have responsibility towards myself, or do I have responsibility to not have slavery anywhere? Okay, and I think it demands a change in identity to get to the ability to say that. Yeah. Yes.
I think there's a really, a strange irony in the last two points that you make, that we have this idea, we conflated holiness and ownership, and we have this idea that we own and have, full right to the land of Israel. But at the same time, because of other parts of our tradition, we don't feel, or we don't embody the feeling of being powerful. We still see ourselves, despite feeling like we have ownership, we still see ourselves as insecure in some way.
I don't know, I was
just trying to resolve it. I think that's probably, it's not only unique to Jews. We could see that with majorities in this country right now as well, and shifting fears of being displaced, even though they're very powerful, things like that.
Right. Right. I think it's important what you're saying. And I'll say again, I think it's why it's so important for us to feel strong. I sometimes say to my kids, when they say they don't want to share, it's mine, I don't want to share. It's only because it's yours that you can share it. Okay? So that's exactly what you're talking about. Right? If it wasn't ours, I couldn't share it with others. But since it's mine, I can treat Harabait differently. Okay? It's exactly... Yuffy. We'll take one or two more questions and then we'll end.
I don't know if you can tease out a little more sort of the difference between something holy becoming every day and something holy, but still keeping it so that it becomes not a tool. And how you think about, how can I take something sacred and, going by a sacred place every day and not using it as a shortcut, but still having it be an everyday thing.
Right. Look, I think you're right. In other words, this definition doesn't mean that holiness can't be a regular part of my life. Okay? But it does mean that I experience it as it is rather than try to change it. Okay, so maybe that's a help. I don't try to change it and I don't take advantage of it. Okay? I can go to the Kotel every day. I think if I had to pay dues to enter, there'd be something there that is contradictory to the holy. Okay? I don't know if that helps, but I think that's part of it. And here, I want to be careful. In other words, I think Bialik is worth working on in the sense of what he wanted to keep as Kodesh and what not. Okay, I don't think he was afraid of Kodesh, but I think he did want to turn more things into useful, in that sense, Chol. Okay? Yes, Yofi. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.